Chapter 27, The End of the Trail, Panama. After the rescue, we suffered for days from the kickback of emotional strain. We were weak and exhausted. Captain Dobbs and his crew did everything that they possibly could for us. The captain even offered, if necessary, to give up the chance of a $10,000 tuna catch in order to rush me to medical aid. During the 3 days we steamed toward the mainland, I began to feel better, though I darn near froze to death because the ice in which I was packed was made from brine. The pain subsided and my temperature went down. It was 103 the day I was rescued. Radiograms from our parents and friends and from all parts of the United States poured in. We even garnered that immediate reward of temporary fame, or notoriety, an offer from the movies. Needless to say, we were not anxious to commemorate the horrors of the Cocos predicament on celluloid. We wanted to forget it as fast as we could. At Cape Blanco, we learnt that there was no hospital in Punta Arenas, and that I would have to be transferred to San Jose. Captain Dobbs then suggested that as long as the ice pack treatment seemed to be helping the appendix, it might be a good idea to remain on board. He had read somewhere, he said, that packing in ice sometimes cured an attack of appendicitis. So we cruised along the coast of Costa Rica for the next 10 days. By the end of that time, I felt much better. On the return trip south, the pain disappeared completely, and we felt like traveling again. Despite the captain's protests, we loaded the Vagabunda overside, but before leaving we gave Captain Dobbs a letter absolving him from all responsibility for anything that might happen to us. Then we started down the coast towards Panama. On the way we left Coco with a kindly native family who had never seen a trained dog before, and were amazed and delighted when she responded to our commands. Although we hated to give her up, we dared not take her into the canal zone. The quarantine regulations were very strict. When we finally put into the canal zone, it seemed that we were going to have serious difficulty with the port officials. While in Corinto, we had written a letter to the port captain, stating that we had traveled all the way down the coast as a regular ship, carrying the same ship's papers that a 10,000-ton freighter would carry, and if possible we wanted to transit the canal with the same status. We said that we had read the canal zone regulations, but would he please make two exceptions? Would he instruct the boarding party of 5 men to board us one at a time? And since the rules called for a pilot aboard at all times, would he please pick a small, thin one? As we pulled into the harbor of Panama, word was sent out to proceed to a position between piers 18 and 19 in front of the Pacific Terminal building, where the offices of the port captain, etc., were located, and to hoist our quarantine flag and stand by. We obeyed. But earlier that day we had fought a tropical storm in the Gulf of Panama, and the Vagabunda had threatened to go to pieces like the one hoss shay. The mast split, the boom pulled off, the zipper round the cockpit parted at the fabric. The Vagabunda was clearly on her last legs, and it seemed doubtful if she could make port. We got her in, but it was a dilapidated pair of adventurers in a badly battered craft that paddled between the two long docks and stood by. Our quarantine flag was a yellow rag tied to the harpoon shaft, stuck in the mast seat. While we waited for official recognition, crowds lined the docks, cameras clicked, and plenty of good-natured ribbing floated to us across the water. Then a delegation of port officials, dressed in gold-braided white uniforms, motioned us in. They were stern-faced and most businesslike. Let me see your clearance papers for this port, one said curtly. I will examine your bills of health, said another. A third began asking questions and filling in a form. Any explosives aboard? Any stowaways? When were you last fumigated? What is your fuel consumption per hour? Number of passenger accommodations? And so on. Everyone was as sober as a judge about to pronounce sentence. We were scared to death. The quarantine officer looked over our bills of health. You have called at more ports than any ship that has ever gone through the canal, he said. It is going to take two forms to list them, and there will be an extra charge for that. The port captain interrupted. While we're talking about charges, do you know what it costs to transit the canal? No, sir, I answered meekly. He cleared his throat and looked at us sternly. Some ships pay toll charges of as much as $30,000, and it's just as much work to put your little 16-foot craft through the locks as it is to put through a big freighter. We have to open and close the gates just the same, fill the chambers with water, and all the rest of it. Do you have any idea of what that's going to cost you? Ginger and I groaned. This was something that neither of us had thought about. Then the admeasurer stepped forward, whose job it is to figure the displacement of the ship about to transit the canal. He stood on the dock, looking down at our tiny cockpit, and then stepped gingerly into it. He was a big, broad-shouldered chap, and the canoe sank about 6 inches under his weight. He got down on his hands and knees, working his big body into the confines of the cockpit, unreeled about 10 inches of his 100-yard tape line, and started measuring the Vagabunda's draft. His shoulders began to shake. He sputtered and gulped, and finally abandoned all efforts to suppress his mirth. Ha, 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 he roared. We looked up at the dock. All the other officials were shaking with laughter, too. Now they jerked us up on the dock and began to congratulate us. When the crowd surged in, almost pushing us back into the water, the canal zone police rushed to our rescue and to protect the canoe from the usual vandals who had come armed with pocket knives, intent upon souvenirs. Then, amid the cranking of cameras and the shouts of the bystanders, the police broke a trail to the main dock for us, a bedraggled, salt-encrusted, bewildered pair. Aboard the U.S. Army transport Chateau Thierry, we were given the stateroom reserved for high army officials. Stewards came and went. Soap, towels, and clean clothes were laid out. After we had made ourselves presentable, we went down to the officers' mess, where a big table groaned under all the dishes that we especially like and had missed for 3 years. While we were eating, port officials and officers crowded round us with questions. Their curiosity was legitimate. Anyone who would come from San Diego in a 16-foot canoe must be crazy, and they wanted to see for themselves just how cracked we were. Then in came the port captain, his face wreathed in smiles as he extended the courtesy of the Panama Canal Zone to the crew of the Vagabunda. The admeasurer appeared, wearing a long face and carrying several pieces of paper covered with figures. "Are you ready for the sad news?" he inquired. "Feel strong enough to take it?" "We might just as well get it over with," I answered. He looked as though he would like to smile, but he didn't. Instead, he scowled. "It's been a big job to figure out your toll charges, and the best I can do for you, young man, is 75 cents. When do you want to start?" "Tomorrow." And right then and there we paid out 75 cents to the Canal Zone Administration, but we didn't begin the transit of the canal for several days. That night, Commander Brown, USN, entertained us at his residence. Someone poured Ginger into an evening gown whose long skirt she had an awful time managing after 3 years of shorts. I had on borrowed plumage, too, a white suit that fitted very well. Later, after the party was over, we shut the door of our bedroom and surveyed our lovely surroundings. Ginger walked over and felt the bed. "It's 3 years," she reminisced, "since we've slept between linen sheets on a spring mattress. Won't it be swell?" And how we would sleep, I thought. But the next morning, when our host failed to waken us by tapping on the door, he peeked in. We were sound asleep on the floor. After lying on hard surfaces for 3 years, we couldn't adjust ourselves to the soft mattress in one night. As guests of the army, we spent a full day of sightseeing, ending with a night at Fort Clayton. Then for our last day and night in Panama City, the Navy again took us in tow. Luncheon, a cocktail party, and tea were followed by a dinner party, which Admiral Williams gave for us aboard his flagship, the USSS Memphis. After dinner came Ginger's crowning moment as she stepped on deck with Mrs. Williams, feeling very elegant in her long evening gown. The assembled sailors snapped to salute. We were then taken to see our first motion picture in 3 years. The next day we started through the canal. As we entered the chamber of the first lock, behind a big ship, we were surprised at the number of people who had gathered to watch the smallest vessel ever to transit the Panama Canal officially. The locks began to fill, and the Vagabunda slowly rose as millions of gallons of water poured into the chamber. When we reached the level, the gates ahead of us opened, and we followed the steamer into the second lock. Men had the canoe by ropes, but big ships are taken through the locks by means of electric donkeys. Now the gates of the second chamber closed behind us. Again we rose, this time to the level of Miraflores Lake, which is 50 feet above the sea. The Canal Zone Mosquito Fleet met us in the lake and escorted us with great merriment to the third lock, Pedro Miguel Lock, which is on the Pacific side. The fleet comprised every conceivable kind of small craft, kayaks, motorboats, rowboats, and so on. The Pedro Miguel Sea Scouts were also out to convoy us. The boys had planned a potluck dinner in their clubhouse, they said. Would we be their guests? We had to go through the locks on schedule, but we promised that we would break our journey after passing through Pedro Miguel Lock. We did, and had a fine time. Paddling through the canal was fun all around. Every ship that passed whistled a salute. Pilots and officers waved. In Culebra Cut, we stopped to see the great dredgers at work, and we visited the Darien Naval Radio Station, where there was another grand party. We've never been able to make up our minds as to which takes the most stamina, a round of fiestas a la Elena, or transiting the Panama Canal in a canoe. You have to be good to do either. We crossed Gatun Lake, the largest man-made lake in the world, on a squally day, and did not arrive at Gatun Locks until well after dark, wet, bedraggled, and tired. The next morning we made the descent through the locks to Limon Bay, which is accomplished in 3 steps. As the canoe zigzagged her way through the chambers that lowered her to sea level, we were feeling as weary and battered as our outfit looked. At Cristobal, we moored the canoe to a dock, and while waiting for Captain and Marie Fisher to arrive, took one last picture of the Vagabunda before we lifted her from the water for the last time. There she sat, her hull weather-beaten, scarred, and twisted out of shape, the names of 100 ports of call carved in the railing on her cockpit. For her, a life of adventure had ended. We spent a week in Cristobal. Then the Vagabunda was loaded aboard a passenger vessel, and we three transited the canal to the Pacific, retracing in 7 days the route which had taken us 3 years to cover. We had arrived in Cristobal on October 9th, 1936, 3 years to the day after leaving San Diego. The question most frequently asked us since our return is, how does it feel to be back? That is not an easy question to answer. We left the United States at the height of the Depression and returned to find things booming, some things. Progress along scientific and mechanical lines can be taken for granted. But what of social relationships, the things that really count? I am afraid that we no longer fit into the picture. While we were a part of organized society, much that we now see went unnoticed. The increasing reluctance and inability of large groups to solve their own problems. People's growing distaste for economic, social, and political freedom, if it entails personal responsibility. Their willingness to barter these things for someone's promise of a larger life with a minimum of effort on the part of the individual. The tendency of more and more people to regard governmental relief agencies as a career. Their naive belief that a political messiah or an economic formula can do for them the things that all men must do for themselves or perish. Another disadvantage to living in a civilized society is that there is no time left for playing. About the grimmest thing we've seen since our return is the hot spot, where everybody tries so damned hard to relax. And boredom, like prosperity, is just round the corner. I wonder if one had $1 million to spend and combed the United States for the guest list, whether it would be possible to throw one of Elena's parties and get the same joyous response. When the natives work, they work hard, and conversely, when they play, they play. Having no passion for getting ahead, the fact that they are behind the Joneses in no wise disturbs them. In this, they are decidedly realistic, and it is we who are foolish and impractical. They love life and live it while they are able. The theory that it is desirable to forego pleasures in the present, that you may in some mythical future enjoy the provisions stored up for the rainy day, would leave any intelligent Indio cold. Furthermore, he isn't interested in exercising power through the possession of things. He suspects that you can't take them with you, and at best the tenure is brief. Since most of what he needs he produces, he naturally doesn't have to cope with the problems that beset highly organized, interdependent societies. Paris may decree shorter skirts for women, and the edict will affect the lives and fortunes of millions who never heard of Schiaparelli or Captain Molyneux. The native grower only knows that for some inexplicable reason, his product, cotton, wool, silk, has become a drug on the market. For him, it is a major calamity. Of course, a few smart people in an organized society exercise their foresight and escape, but most of us aren't smart. There's a chance to beat a malarial mosquito because nature gives her creatures a break. When you fight disease, you aren't fighting something you are totally unequipped to face. The problems nature presents you with can, for the most part, be met by intelligence, work, discipline, and knowledge. And there is something else to be said for wresting a livelihood from natural resources. There is the priceless satisfaction of knowing that you've taken nothing from anyone, that your place in the sun isn't contingent upon crowding your fellows into outer darkness. To live the simple life isn't easy. It's hard if you hate work. But nature is just, or so it seems to us. The results of your efforts are concrete. If you fail in any enterprise, there is nothing mysterious about it, and there is always something that you can do to prevent its recurrence. Cause and effect are not obscured through 100 intermediaries. Thank God there is nothing indefinite about natural law. If you live in accordance with it, study its inexorable rules, it will reward you, and the slicker can't beat it. Personally, we prefer to take our chances with its hazards rather than attempt to fit ourselves into the confused pattern of the modern social order. Physical injuries and hardships may damage you, but they are soon forgotten. The psychic injuries of a competitive life are too high a price to pay for us in exchange for its dubious benefits. Our trip was made for purely personal reasons. At the outset, we had no particular belief in its interest or value to anyone else. That, perhaps, is the written record's greatest flaw. Many things of general interest that we might have learnt and reported are obscured by the personal. Primarily, we wanted to find out something about ourselves and our capacities. Whether our romantic daydreams of a fuller and more colorful life could stand up against the actualities. For us, these questions are answered. For whoever reads this book, who knows?